The ship is ours!
Gentlemen, I be placed in a bewilderment. There I were, resting. And upon a sudden, I hear an ungodly row on deck.
Would be that, first mate?
Mutiny, Captain.
Mutiny.
And what fate befalls mutineers? Now, we know the answer to that, do we not? Mutineers...
I wish to report a mutiny.
Ian McShane almost convinces audiences that they're not there to see Johnny Depp in that scene from Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, the film we'll be discussing on this week's show. It's good work, Ian, but sadly not enough. I'm Dan Persons, and I'm here with CineFantastique online editor Steve Bedrowski. Hey, Steve.
Hello.
And also San Francisco Bureau Chief Lawrence French. How you doing, Larry?
Oh, pretty good.
And this is the CineFantastique Spotlight, the audio review of science fiction, fantasy, and horror cinema.
Can I just interrupt here and say that Larry sounds far too cheerful considering that we're recording this at 9 a.m.?
Why, I think that's fair. Larry, tone it down a bit. You're embarrassing the rest of us.
Okay.
Jesus Christ. When do you go to bed, Larry?
Usually I'm not up at very early, so...
Yeah, I know. So I don't know.
Make you sure, I guess.
Either that or you should get up early, or you should at least tell us what coffee you're drinking.
I only drink tea in the morning.
Really?
That's it.
That's
okay.
It.
Trade the coffee for tea.
Clearly not sleepy time.
Mm.
So, but let's talk about Pirates of the Caribbean, shall we?
I don't mind.
Okay, so let me give you a little bit of the plot line here. In Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, the fourth installment of the immensely, some would say distressingly popular film franchise based on the justly popular Disney theme park ride, Johnny Depp's lovable rogue, Captain Jack Sparrow, is back and fallen in with Blackbeard the Pirate, played by Ian McShane, in a quest for the legendary Fountain of Youth. They're joined by Blackbeard's toothsome daughter, Angelica. Note the ironic naming. She's played by Penelope Cruz. And they're pursued by Sparrow's old nemesis, Captain Barbossa, played by Geoffrey Rush, who's now in the employ of the British Crown. And there are some Spanish dudes also after the fountain. And... that's pretty much the game. Set sail, retrieve some magical artifacts, get some mermaid excrescences, and take advantage of the fountain for reasons that I'm not really sure of and frankly don't care about. And Steve, you know, it's sort of, weirdly, it's sort of the Jonah Hex situation for me again. I mean, there's lots of stuff going on. You got sword fights and magic and ships and... sexy vampire mermaids and people falling off cliffs and all of that. And I don't give a fuck about any of it. How about you?
Yeah, I do give a fuck about parts of it. Just really? Not the main parts of it.
Yeah, that's...
No, since you brought... I was going to say this later, but since you brought it up, the co-stars kind of steal the show. I mean, there's not much of interest with Captain Jack Sparrow. He doesn't have a clear goal, you know, screenwriting 101, what's at stake for him? He's just along for the ride. Ian McShane, as you said, is quite good as Blackbeard. That's interesting. And then the kind of love story romance between the preacher and the mermaid, Sam Claflin, I believe, and Astrid Berger Frisbee. You know, that stuff is interesting. There's like a movie there kind of wedged in between the crap that the screenwriters, Elliot and Rossio, think that the Pirates fans want to see.
Well, here's the weird thing, and maybe one of you can correct me on this, but I believe I read somewhere that Johnny Depp wanted to like this film at the very least to be Captain Jack's exit film, and possibly even that he wanted to have less of a burden in the film. And so I'm getting the feeling, and Larry, tell me if you feel this way, that this was actually sort of intended to be more of an ensemble piece, except that in the end they sort of forgot the ensemble.
Interesting. Actually, I thought I didn't think that at all, because I thought this one actually focused more on Captain Black. Of course, there is the new younger co-star, and so there is that, but it wasn't really an ensemble piece because their story is completely separate, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we get rid of Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley, which I think is only for the good, because I
yes.
was terribly excited by their thing, but. I think the fact that they actually just got rid of the whole, you know, they weren't trying to tie it in with other three movies, so they based it on this novel that apparently, and adapted it for the actual Johnny Depp character.
But the Tim Powell's novel on Stranger Tides.
Right. Yeah. And I don't. Yeah,
By the way, which Steve pointed out to us.
Right. But Johnny Depp is it's quite obvious because it's in the credits. But I think Johnny Depp has already said he's going to do number five, or he's willing to entertain it, and obviously be crazy not to for $30 million.
Money talks. Yes.
Yes. But you know, you bring up this point, and both of you express pleasure in the fact that Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom are no longer in this. And my question to you is, really, when what we've got is the relationship between Johnny Depp and Penelope Cruz, and let's be honest about it, there is no relationship between Johnny Depp and Penelope Cruz. You can tell this is the age of magic that this is taking place in, because there's absolutely no chemistry going on.
Well, let me put it to you this way. If your living room is overcrowded and you have a crappy old couch that's all beat up, you throw it away. Now, if you're so stupid that you buy an even worse piece of crap and put it in its place, it still was a good idea to get rid of the old couch. Does that answer your question?
It was good
to get rid of them. You know, what they replaced it with was not an improvement, but you know.
So you're saying that they got rid of the couch, and instead of going to Stickley, they went with the IKEA. Is that what you're saying?
Not even IKEA. It's like they went into the garbage dump outside IKEA or something. And
dumpster diving.
No, I have no idea why Penelope Cruz is in movies. Well, I mean, I know she's pretty, but she's not so pretty that she hypnotizes you into overlooking the deficiency of talent.
I suspect that hat was meant to hypnotize us.
Maybe. It didn't work.
I think it has the same powers as the hats of the Adjustment Bureau.
No, because they aren't working, whatever they're supposed to.
Yeah. You know, Larry, and Steve mentioned this too. I mean, Steve was pleased with the new relationship that they had, which is this actor, Sam Claflin, who plays the preacher, Philip, and Astrid Burgess Frisbee, who plays the unfortunately named Sirena, the mermaid. Here.
Serena, isn't it?
Serena, yeah, it is Serena. I'm reading literally from the credits, so it's Serena with a Y. So there you go. They make it obvious in the writing, if not in the actual speaking of the line. But Larry, I gather you were pleased with this relationship as well, and I was not, because I found it just particularly poignant. At least with Orlando Bloom, he had some sort of presence and some sort of action function. This priest was just there just to sort of mope around and be, I guess, what amounts to a moral center for the film, and possibly, a sop to the religious right in some bizarre. I get some bizarre feeling that that's what he's meant to be. But I saw this guy. He shows up, and I go, "What the hell is this? Is he supposed to be like the Justin Bieber crowd? Is he supposed to be this puppy dog?" Cute figure to get in that particular sector of the audience. What did you think?
Well, it's funny because, they usually put in a character like that when the main star is a little getting older, like Mel Gibson or something. So they have a younger second lead. And, Johnny Depp doesn't have a romantic interest, really, because, as you noticed, there is no chemistry between him and Penelope Cruz. That didn't bother me so much, though, because they're really not supposed to have chemistry. I mean, she's the daughter of Blackbeard, so, and they're supposedly, trying to outfox each other all the way through. So that wasn't so upsetting to me. But with this new younger character, I think it's just the idea, as you say, to appeal to the younger female audience who isn't going to find Johnny Depp flouncing around in his black eye makeup that attractive, I guess. But I don't really know.
Well, I don't think it's a sop to the religious right. I mean, they wouldn't go for that character at all. Falls in love with a mermaid and goes off with her at the end.
Whoops. Yeah, I get it.
Yes, he's a priest. Pretty bizarre.
they frown on that sort of thing in the pews.
No, I don't find his presence there that mysterious. I mean, when you have characters, you want different characters. If you got a bunch of characters that are following their self-interest, you want someone who's some kind of an idealist there to provide a contrast. I mean, it's not interpolated necessarily so well into the script, but it's an interesting plot line.
Oh, hell yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you there. Let me ask you a bit about Rob Marshall, because he is replacing Gore Verbinski on this, who did the first three films. And Rob Marshall is probably most famous for doing the screen adaptation of the musical Chicago, which he won an Oscar for, I think, or the film won an Oscar, and is a very good film, I thought, and a not so good film adaptation of the musical Nine. And here he has done straight drama before, I think. I'm not sure he's done like real straight up fantasy set aside from sort of the surreal musical fantasy sort of thing that he's done. But straight up fantasy, I don't think he's done. And my sort of sense of it was I got the feeling like he was just cashing the check and telling the DP which way to point the camera. Did you get anything more out of his contribution, Steve?
Well, no, but then I don't expect auteurist posturing in a Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I mean, Gore Verbinski is not a good director, but, he made one good Pirates movie, Lightning Struck for number one, and then that's it. I can't stand any of Verbinski's other films, and... this is Hollywood filmmaking. It's a Jerry Bruckheimer production. That's what they hire the director to do, is tell a DP where to point the camera. get it in the can. It's like old style Hollywood, you know, here's your job, do it. And well, get out of here, you know. Style is not required, you know.
I would argue that old style Hollywood is where the auteur concept was born.
No, it was born in France.
Well, it was born in France, but in an observation of the old style Hollywood process, that actually within the factory, the directors were developing as.
Yes, you are correct. But then the auteurs were the exception to the rule. You know, most directors were not. It was like the producer directors, like Howard Hawks, who gained control of their films.
But Larry, for whatever deficiencies Gore Verbinski may have, you know, my feeling was, and I didn't see the third film at World's End, but the two films I did see and the other Verbinski films I have seen, I would say at least there was some degree of style that he brought to it, some verve that he was able to bring to it. And I felt that was lacking here. How about you?
No, because I like this one better than the other two, or the other three, I should say. And I didn't like even the first one. So this one, to me, is actually the best of the four. And I think Rob Marshall does bring something to it. He brings a sort of choreography that he's very good at in musicals. And, you know, there are sword fights and so forth. And I think he does have better material to work with, too. One of the things I liked about the story was it sort of reminded me of an old Harryhausen film because, you know, it's a quest. They're going on the Fountain of Youth. So it has a sort of straightforward narrative after a lot of silly opening shenanigans where, you know, they're being chased around London, which I thought was so ridiculous. But, you know, once they get on board the ship, I thought it was very interesting because they bring Jeffrey Rush back, and I thought he was much better in this film than he had been in the other two. And he sort of plays, you know, he's actually supposed to be an evil character, but he becomes more like the second lead, and he's out for revenge. So he's very interesting along the way. And I think that so they bring in Ian McShane as the basically the new villain character. And I think that works fairly well. And, of course, they're going off after the Fountain of Destiny. The weak point is, why is Johnny Depp trying to go for the fountain? I mean, there's absolutely no, as we brought up before, there's no reason why he should want to get there.
Well, Steve, I mean, you did bring that up. That is one of the big flaws here is, what the heck is Jack Sparrow doing? And you actually made a good point about one of the earlier scenes with Jack Sparrow.
Which scene was that?
The scene, his audience with the king.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. Because he supposedly he needs a ship. He wants to get theoretically to the Fountain of Youth. And basically he's offered everything he needs, but for some reason, he starts a fight, and that's just one of the, you know, that's Rossio and Elliot. They love to, you know, the audience wants the action scene. So I guess he just didn't want to be on the ship with Barbossa again. But even that makes no sense. We know there was enmity between the two characters, but although they never, you know, shook hands and made up, their personal differences were kind of superseded by other concerns in the third pirate movie. Mm. So the idea that just the mere sight of Barbossa would provoke Sparrow into, you know, starting a fight and, you know, running out on basically giving up everything he wants and needs, you know, being handed to him on a silver platter. Yeah, it makes no sense. It's just an excuse for, like Larry said, the shenanigans. And yeah. I just wanted to say, regarding how good this is compared to the other Pirates films, I'll go this far with Larry. It's the best of the sequels. It's easily better than the two sequels. And in spite of all my reservations about it, there were actually parts of it I enjoyed, which I can't say about either of the other two follow-ups.
Well, you know what? I'll say this about the two previous films. Here's a little anecdote for you, is that I went to see the second film, Dead Man's Chest. And so I'm sitting and I'm watching the film, and I get a little thirsty. And I never do this. I've never done it since. I've never done it before. I get up and I go out of the theater and I go to the concession stand and I get myself a soda and I come back and go back into the film. And then a little later on, you know, maybe a half hour later, I'm starting to feel a little drowsy. And so I closed my eyes and took a nap. Not a long nap, maybe like 5 minutes, but let me tell you something. In both of those cases, not only did I not get the feeling that I missed anything, I hadn't actually missed anything. And this leads me to the question with this film. Steve, do you have any idea why this film is 2 hours? I think it's 2 hours and 17 minutes. Long. I thought it was 2 hours and 20 minutes. But any idea why this film is 2 hours and 17 minutes long?
Just they've established the precedent that these are supposed to be big action-adventure films filled with lots of action and adventure, hence the ridiculous scene we just discussed a moment ago with the fight. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether it contributes to the story. And also, I mean, let's be honest, the main source of inspiration for the story here, or of all the sequels, maybe even the first one, is not Pirates of the Caribbean. It's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's how can we get different characters with conflicting goals into the same story and have them form alliances and then renege on promises or double cross people or backstab or whatever. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether it propels the story. It's just, well, let's just do that some more, and then the character will join with this, and then it'll go move and change alliances with someone else. And let's just do that as much as possible and, you know, drag things out as long as possible and make it into an epic so people will feel they got their money's worth when they pay, you know, $16 for the 3D ticket.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Larry, do you think this film would be better served by maybe trimming down a little bit?
Oh, yes. Just, you know, as we were talking about, that opening fight sequences was so extended and overblown. It was just, mm-hmm. and it was so ridiculous. So, why, you know, I could see having a 5 minute fight, but it goes on for 10 minutes. You know, they're chasing him around London and practically, whatever, 500. Guards of the palace are after him. Of course, he manages to somehow escape them all, which is, you know, it just it goes on way too long, and it should have been trimmed way down. And, you know, there's places all through the movie where they could have trimmed scenes, but they do bring in these other characters, so you have to develop time with them too. So that's why you do have a sort of overblown running time.
I sort of suspect that there are very few scenes in this film that wouldn't have benefited by being cut in half. You know, just my feeling. I wanted to ask you whether you thought about one particular element of this, which is that, as I mentioned, Jack Sparrow falls in with Blackbeard and they set sail on Blackbeard's ship. And Steve, you had mentioned this and I agree with you on this. Maybe you want to talk a little bit more about it. But the ship, in terms of a production design piece, is a beautiful piece of work. It's ratty. The sails are ripped. It's dark and mysterious and brooding. It's got these sort of flame candles or flames at the front of it to guide its way, and it's a really neat piece of work. But it's also got a unique bit of weaponry on board, which is a flamethrower that shoots flames out of the front of the ship, and it's beautiful to look at, and it's a great little set piece when it happens. However, have you thought about the logic of this? Because if you look at it closely, you've got the ship, it fires off these gouts of flame, and let's give it the benefit of the doubt, and say it shoots flames out 100 feet ahead. I think that's fair. And so in combat, what you've got is the ship shooting these flames out, and then because it is a big lumbering ship, it's got to move forward right into the path of whatever the hell it just set fire to.
You're making assumptions here that are very, very much in doubt.
How so?
This was in any way intended as a combat weapon. I think it was intended for the use that we see it put to in the film itself. It clearly has nothing to do with what you do when you see another ship that you're going to attack.
It's just a torture device.
It's just Blackbeard having fun.
This is Blackbeard's little toy. This is when we do see it, it is as an act of retribution, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give too much away from it, but you're saying that you're saying essentially this is Blackbeard's little toy.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, because as a strategic weapon, it doesn't make sense at all, does it,
no,
Larry?
No, not at all. Not at all.
How about you, Larry? Did you think about it at all? Did you catch that?
Well, no, because it's so ridiculous in the first place. But, you know, in an old realistic pirate movie, they would, you know, have somebody walk the plank or keyhole them, but you know, you can't do that for a Pirates of the Caribbean movie, so you have to find a spectacular way to kill them. Of course, you know, there's no way, realistic way, that any real pirate ship could have flamethrowers at the front at that time, so they presumably it's a supernatural ability obtained by Blackbeard somehow.
Blackbeard and his magic sword. I'm checking Wikipedia quick because and I'm seeing the image here. It was Blackbeard who was supposed to be famous for sticking flaming brands in his beard in order to intimidate his foes. So there's an historic grounding for this. Steve, did you want to talk a little bit about Blackbeard's ship?
I think you said it all. I mean, it's the skulls are nice. It's black. It's like, you know, a vessel of doom. It was fantastic. It does tie in with something that bothered me just a little bit. I mean, it looks like something that's not of this earth. And they go to some lengths to show Blackbeard using magic powers. He seemed to me like somebody who was already beyond life and death, and that kind of undermined the whole search for the Fountain of Youth. I mean, it really seemed like a ghost ship, and he seemed like somebody who was already back from the dead. But, of course, they needed, you know, for the plot to work, they needed him to be still mortal. And, you know, and so, yeah, it would have worked better as, you know, another version of the Flying Dutchman. But I guess they did a ghost ship in part two or something. So don't want to keep doing the same thing over and over again. Right?
Why? Oh, of course not, Steve. Do you suppose that was perhaps a last-minute rewrite? Because what you suggest falls more in line with the other Pirates of the Caribbean films. It certainly falls in with the first film, definitely.
I doubt it's a rewrite because, again, although I understand that the script does not hew closely to the novel on Stranger Tides, the novel is about Blackbeard. He does use black magic, and he is in the quest for the Fountain of Youth. So I assume that was always part of the story and probably about the only thing they kept from the book.
Mm-hmm. I've heard great things about that book, and I've never read it, and I probably need to get around to checking that out. That's Tim Powers on Stranger Tides we're talking about here. Larry, there was one other bit of production design that I thought was pretty neat, and that was the Fountain of Youth itself. And I thought it was the set itself was beautiful, but tell me if when you first saw that, you were expecting at some point that the set, that the fountain itself at some point was going to go a question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question. Because what struck me most prominently is that the set is almost a direct lift of The Guardian of Time from A City on the Edge of Forever, from Star Trek.
Oh, really? I haven't seen that for so long, I couldn't remember. Oh.
Steve, do you remember?
Yes, I remember, but I mean, it doesn't bother me that filmmakers of our generation are, you know, doing little visual callbacks to things they saw when they grew up. I mean, that's fine. Mm-hmm. It's not a flaw. And
I'm not necessarily calling it a flaw, but I'm just making note of.
Actually, yeah, I wasn't very impressed with that Fountain of Youth set. I mean, the actual set, yes, but the fountain itself, no, because it's this little trickle of water, and it's like, you know, I'm expecting this big fountain like you saw in The Golden Voyage of Sinbad or something, and in Stonehenge around it. Instead, you have this little arch with a little trickle of water coming out of it. I thought that was a big disappointment.
It's more like the pisser of youth, isn't it?
It's hella lame.
It's certainly not a very impressive fountain. There's better fountains than, you know, any public building.
Right. Yeah, we could go drive 5 minutes from any of our homes and find a more impressive looking fountain. Yeah, you're right, Larry. The second half of the film does really start to feel like a Harryhausen film, and yeah, you should be expecting the set from Golden Voyage of Sinbad at the end, not this little grotto with some rocks. Yeah, that was weak. Sorry.
is there anything else that we need to talk about before we go into spoilers?
The whole mermaid thing bothered me with the lighthouse bit, that they have to attract them with this light, and then it builds to the suspense thing, like Captain Jack's going to turn the light off. And I'm like, you know, the point of the light was to draw them there. It's not like the light disappears and they go away. It's like they're already there causing mayhem. Turning the light off isn't going to do anything. And then having established that you got to go to all these lengths to attract the mermaids, like practically the next scene is when the English ship arrives and it gets capsized and taken down by the mermaids. I'm like, so I guess you really didn't need to turn the light on to draw them. They would have shown up anyway. But that's just, like I said, it's lazy screenwriting. It's like somebody said, when Captain Barbossa's men show up, we don't want them to outnumber Blackbeard's men. What can we do about that? Oh, we'll just, you know, kill up the entire crew. Yeah, whatever. What the fuck, you know?
Well, that's convenient. Larry, anything else you want to discuss?
No, I think we're ready for spoilers.
Okay, so we're going to go into the spoiler section right now. This is the point where we start talking about stuff that you may not want to hear about if you haven't already seen Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. So if you want to miss these delicate bits of plot, you should fast forward to 43 minutes and 15 seconds. And we are now in the spoiler section. This is your final warning. And really, I've got just one minor thing that I want to ask both of you about. And Steve will probably knock this down fairly quickly and easily, but it puzzled me as well. You know, we went through all this stuff, and the requirements for actually activating the Fountain of Youth is that you have to have these two goblets that Ponce de Leon had in his possession, and you've got to have some mermaid tears as well. And my question is this: since Ponce de Leon, since Ponce de Leon found the discovered the fountain and had these goblets with him, and the goblets are manufactured, they're inscribed in Latin, but Ponce de Leon is following a legend of the Fountain of Youth, which meant that it had to exist before Ponce de Leon got there, and people had to know that it would in that it would grant youth. So my question is, where the fuck did those goblets come from?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, exactly. Did he have a manufacturer? I mean, were they hanging around outside on a hook? What?
Well, what's even more strange is, you know, the Spanish king wants the Fountain of Youth too. So it's like we send him there. And of course, when they get there, he crushes the goblets. And says,
well, yeah.
No, this is...
Well, yeah. That, well, that's the other thing is that before that, they had the goblets already.
Remember, Ponce de Leon is from a previous generation, in fact, two or three back, and the crown has changed hands a few times.
Yeah.
So new king, new policy.
Yeah, that's well. I mean, here, yeah, I guess so. Here's my point, though. And first off, aren't the Spanish real dicks at the end?
No.
No, you know, I this is weird because supposedly they're supposed to be like sort of the moral, I guess they're supposed to be here again, a moral presence. You know, there is only one creator of life and that is God. But God, they ask like they come off like such dicks. You didn't think so, Steve?
No, they make a point that they encounter the British ship. They don't bother to try to destroy it. They're just going on their mission. I mean, what? They kill one guy, but note his bravery. So I think by the standards of the era in which it was set, they're not doing too bad. And also keeping in mind the characters who surround them. I mean, you know, when you have Blackbeard in this tale and all these other, you know, louts. Yeah, they don't come across too bad.
Larry, you didn't feel they were sort of dickish?
No, I didn't. And they're just sort of, you know, they're more like just plot devices, though. So they come across very cardboard-like to me. And you know, they're there. Like I said, the whole thing with the goblets, they're so interested in the fountain. And then as soon as they get there, you know, it's just as like to have a surprise. Let's have the head guy, you know, toss them away. It's also a device so the mermaid can come back in the story because she has to rescue them from the, you know, the depths of the ocean floor. And
yeah, but that made no sense. That was why should she give a shit? You know?
Yeah, especially after the way she's been treated. She's so happy to, you know, that to have been tortured by these humans that she's going to come back. And
yeah, that was weak.
Yeah. She saw that Jack Sparrow's heart was pure, despite the drinking and the wenching and the pillaging and the killing. His
and
heart is.
She takes her boyfriend down to the, you know, it's like the ending of Splash. Suddenly, well, Tom Hanks can live underwater.
A lot of it is like Splash, including her growing legs out of water.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Which also is very convenient for a hike across the jungle, I guess.
Yeah, that was just, again, it's laziness. It's like, well, what can we do? Well, the easiest thing is, oh, she has legs.
Yeah. Is there anything else spoilerish you want to bring up?
Yeah, I want to ask whether anyone was indeed surprised by the switching of the chalices at the end.
Oh, fuck no.
I mean, honestly, God.
Yeah, I would have been more surprised if, like, Barbossa near the end had said, you can't surprise a Sicilian.
But it was just, you know, I mean, I kind of had my doubts that Barbossa, being bent on revenge as he was, would leave Blackbeard not fully dead just so we could have that scene at the end, you know, with the chalices. And, you know, as I mentioned in some notes I sent to you, I think there's a real confusion on the part of the screenwriters between youth and immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can be young and still die from having a sword run through you or being poisoned. And my feeling was the surprise ending should have been, yeah, Blackbeard gets to the Fountain of Youth and he turns young, but he dies from his wounds. It's like, not, it was youth, not invulnerability. Should have thought that through a little bit more, Mr. Blackbeard, dumbass, you know.
You know, but basically when you think about it, when you've got a script that crosses mermaids with vampires, pretty much everything is on the table at that point. So.
Yeah, I guess so. And did you stay through the credits for the tag at the end?
No, I didn't. Larry, did you?
Yes, I did. So that's so, another indication there'll be a number five, of course.
Oh, well, big surprise there, too. What did I miss?
Well, they put Johnny Depp as his final act of kindness to Penelope Cruz, maroons her on an island, and she can't convince him that she's really in love with him. So he leaves her stranded there. So
right.
We see her coming back at the end with, and she finds a little voodoo doll that Blackbeard had that he was using to torment Johnny Depp. So she's now got it on the island and can pin him.
So wait a minute, what the fuck? Hold on, that island was in the middle of the ocean, right?
Most islands are.
Yeah, well,
there are very few islands on the side of the ocean.
There are a few. There are probably a few ponds with islands. I don't know. But this island is in the middle of the ocean. And when they tossed that doll away, that was a landbound river, wasn't it?
Rivers flow into the ocean.
Rivers flow into the ocean, but just so coincidentally.
You've forgotten your Shelley, Love's Philosophy. The fountains mingle with the river and the rivers with the ocean.
And the ocean directs the doll directly to the bitch who wants vengeance. Is that the way it goes on?
It's fate that does it. It's a very lame tag because I was more interested in knowing what was going to happen with the mermaid and the preacher. I was expecting them to pop up or something, not a little voodoo doll. Because really, I don't want Penelope Cruz to come back in the next movies.
Yes. You'll see, that'll probably be the opening of the next movie. She's on the island and, you know, a ship sails past and she comes on board. And
just because they tease her reappearance doesn't necessarily mean she's going to be coming back.
We need to start a online campaign.
Yeah, I think so. Let's get those petitions going quick. Presuming we're feeling obligated to cover the next Pirates.
Hey, nobody said your job is easy.
Yeah, I agree. By the way, and this isn't particularly a spoiler, but last I saw it took in $90 million.
So I guess there will be part five, huh?
There will be part five. And you know, and I feel regret because, you know, now my dollars have helped contribute to that. You know, I know mine weren't the tipping point, but nevertheless.
Maybe they were.
Who knows? Good Lord. Yeah, it was those $12. The only thing I feel good about is that at the very least I went in on a senior admission, so I didn't pay the full ducat there. So are we done with spoilers?
I am. Anybody else?
No.
Okay, so we shall now welcome everybody back from the spoiler section. It was a quick one this time, but we covered a few pertinent little bits. And so before we get to the ratings, I think it would be important for us to talk about what we learned from this film. So, Steve, what did you learn from Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides?
You can be murderous, heartless, cruel, awful, evil father, but your daughter will still love you and give up her life for you.
Aw, that's sweet. How about you, Larry?
I'm afraid I learned very little, but I learned it's best to, I'm having a senior moment here.
Well, you want me to drop mine?
Yes.
Okay, so here is what I learned. Hiking through a jungle is sweaty, dirty work. If you're a man, if you're a woman, you stay neat and sexy in your jaunty fucking hat.
Yeah, that's true.
I hate that hat. Larry, anything to add?
No, I'm going to skip it.
Okay. So
it was that bad.
We'll move on to the ratings then. And Larry, Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, 0 to 4 dots. What do you want to give it?
I give it 2 dots. As I say, I did like the new approach, the complete breakaway. And the first, you know, I would give the, especially the 2 sequels, I would give probably no dots whatsoever. So 2 dots is a big come up for me.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Steve?
Well, as I said, I liked the first one a lot. The sequels I thought were abysmal. This one was a big step up. I'm, in spite of everything that's silly and goofy about it, there was enough enjoyable for me to give it 2 dots.
Okay. I'm going to give it 1 dot, mostly for Blackbeard's ship and even the Fountain of Youth, which we sort of ragged on, but I sort of liked the set anyway. The rest was just sort of dull for me. And so that will be it for Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. We do come now to the capsule section, but we didn't talk about this before. Did either of you see any additional films that you want to talk about?
Not me.
How about you, Larry?
Yes, I saw Woody Allen's new movie, which is a sort of marvelous time-traveling comedy. And the time-traveling involves him going back to – Owen Wilson goes to Paris where he's getting married, and he's a hack screenwriter. He probably wrote something like The Pirates of the Caribbean Part 3. So anyway, he's in Paris, and his heroes are Ernest Hemingway and all the writers of the 20s who were living in Paris at the time. And he finds he can magically go back to that time and actually meet Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. And by the way, Louis Bunuel and Salvador Dali and Pablo Picasso. And so Woody Allen has these marvelous actors playing all these famous people from the 20s. And I think it's just a delightful time traveling comedy, because, you know, usually time travel movies are not comedies. They're more likely dramatic things. And this is just like a really delightful comedy because of the way he's.
Did you say the title?
Yeah, I didn't hear the title either.
Oh,
what's
Midnight
the title?
Midnight in Paris.
Say it again.
Midnight in Paris. It's called, and it, you know, it's Woody Allen's latest movie, so it's not like you're going to mistake it for something else.
Right. So how does it compare? You know, a lot of his recent work has not been up to par, but you're making this sound pretty good.
Yeah, this is one of his much better movies. You know, he makes a movie a year, so it's very often he makes a lot of mediocre movies. The last one I thought was very mediocre, too. This one is much better, I think.
It seems like when he leaves his native borough behind and goes into a different time period or something, he gets a little shot of adrenaline there. Things perk up a bit. The ones from the 90s I liked were like, you know, the period pieces like Bullets Over Broadway.
It strikes me that, yeah, like Steve is saying, it seems that when he starts to bring in literary allusions, particularly in a humorous way, he does seem to perk up, you know, and I'm thinking all the way back to his stand-up days when he did this wonderful, hilarious routine about a reminiscence of him and Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso.
And Gertrude Stein punched me in the mouth.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yes. Which was a great bit. And, you know, when he reaches for that, and particularly in doing things even like with Mighty Aphrodite and stuff like that, that seems, as Steve says, to energize him, doesn't it, Larry?
Yeah, well, you saw that when he went to London and he did Match Point, and then that was very successful. And then when he stayed there, he sort of lost some of that originality in his follow-up, because they also shot that in London, and he certainly lost it with last year's film in London with Anthony Hopkins. It was very, very subpar Woody Allen, I thought. So I think, you know, and he went to Barcelona and shot that movie with Penelope Cruz.
No! But that was supposed to be one of his better films.
No, it was good. It was just that, you know, we've been ragging on Penelope Cruz. I thought she was quite good in it, and so it was one of his better films, too.
I remember back in my Dewey youth when a Woody Allen release was cause for both celebration and an obligation. You had to go and see the film, and that's sort of like a long way behind us now. But you're saying that this is the one to catch.
Yes, definitely. If you like, especially if you like, you know, it's not as good as Annie Hall or his earlier triumphs, but mm-hmm. it's certainly worth watching. And it's, you know, it's an very amusing.
And you want to give it a dot rating?
Yeah, we'll give it 3 dots, certainly. And, you know, as I say, if you like going back in time and meeting those people, of course, Gertrude Stein is played by Kathy Bates, so you've got just the conceit and of seeing those people is for a certain segment of the audience is going to be exciting, I think. And Ernest Hemingway, the guy who plays him, is very good, and he's spouting off all his, you know, macho philosophy, which is really hilarious, I thought. Mm-hmm.
By the way, does anybody who's the lead on this?
Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson, is he doing a Woody Allen impression?
Yes, he's the Woody Allen stand-in. So
no, he's Woody Allen's surrogate, but usually right. Coming with the surrogate, they actually try to do an impression of Woody Allen. Did he do that?
Not really an impression, no.
But okay.
You know, he has the same lines that Woody Allen would have if he was going to be playing him.
Okay. Hopefully Woody has gotten over that, because that was the thing I found annoying about sort of like the more recent slate of his comedies, was that he had the lead actor there and they were literally doing Woody Allen. And it was just...
I don't know if Bullets Over Broadway, what's his name, was doing Woody Allen. I mean, definitely in Celebrity, Kenneth Branagh, but yeah. Branagh was good enough to turn it into a performance and not just an impersonation. Yeah. It was kind of funny.
It sort of stuck in my craw, and I'd have to go back and look at Bullets Over Broadway again to see whether it was that blatant or not. But I saw my dim memory suggests that it was. In any case, so if that's it for the capsules, Steve, you want to bring us up to date on what's going to be coming up in the theaters next week?
What's coming up next week is Kung Fu Panda 2.
Ah.
And I like the first Kung Fu Panda, so I'm looking forward to the sequel. They have the same screenwriters back, so hopefully it'll be as good as the first one. New director, Jennifer Yu, replacing Mark Osborne and John Stevenson. I was really happy with Osborne's work on the first one because he did a great short subject I love called More. So I hope the sequel can live up even without his presence. Fantastic voice cast, of course. Jack Black is back as Poe. Angelina Jolie is there, Jackie Chan, Gary Oldman, Seth Rogen, Dustin Hoffman, David Cross, Lucy Liu, Michelle Yeoh, and James Hong. So I'm glad they got a couple of real martial arts actors in there to do voices, you know. So has Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh ever been in a film together? You know, they should have. But,
yeah.
You know.
I've already seen the film, by the way, but I am under embargo, so let me just put it this way. We've got stuff to talk about next week.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. And is that it for theaters?
That's it for what's going on in theaters next time.
Okay, then I think we shall hike our keisters out of here then. So let me just wrap this up by saying that if you want to comment on anything you've heard in this episode or want to comment about anything on genre film at all, you can send that email to podcast@cinefantasticonline.com. And so that will do it for the show. Steve Bedrowski, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Lawrence French, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
And I'm Dan Persons. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC. Copyright 2011, Dan Persons. All rights reserved. No unauthorized duplication permitted.